Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Tonight, we are the greatest hockey team. You were born to be hockey players. Every one of you. And you were meant to be here tonight. This is your time. Now go out there and take it.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, a family meeting about coaching. That doesn't mean it's all about sports, like in that clip, though some of it is. The Knicks this morning are introducing Phil Jackson as their new president. He is one of those rare people in whom pro sports and Zen Buddhism somehow come together. The back page headline in the Daily News when they announced him over the weekend was Zen and Now. The legendary UCLA basketball coach John Wooden lived at that kind of level. Wooden's definition of success?
I coined my own definition of success, which is peace of mind attained only through self-satisfaction and knowing you made the effort to do the best of which you're capable. I believe that's true.
Way beyond sports. So we'll talk later about Phil Jackson and John Wooden and the inner game of coaching that they represent, and about being coached at anything, not just sports, as a path to enlightened living, not just performance, something Phil Jackson would like to talk about. The other coaching news hook this week, of course, is the beginning of March Madness in college basketball. And I think it comes at a time when all of college athletics is being questioned in ways it historically has not been. How the state university coaches get to be the highest paid employees in the entire state government, for example, including the governor and the university president, and the extremely variable commitment of college coaches to education, which college is supposed to be about. And some coaches don't like being asked about their salaries.
You're not really that stupid, are you?
Yeah.
Okay. My best advice to you?
Yeah.
Shut up.
Former University of Connecticut coach John Calhoun, putting it delicately at a news conference in 2009. We will also meet Natalie Randolph today, one of the only women ever to coach a boys' high school football team. Took them to a championship game, in fact. She's coached girls, too, and I expect we'll learn a lot from her about how different coaches motivate and what motivates different kinds of students, boy-girl differences and other kinds of differences, again, sports and non-sports, with Natalie Randolph coming up. I wonder if she ever sent her team out to a game like this.
Clear eyes, full hearts.
Can't lose.
Let's hear it, Gemma. Clear eyes, full hearts.
Can't lose.
Let's go play some football. Let's go, baby.
Recognize that from Friday Night Lights, not exactly Phil Jackson Zen, and the fast-growing field of life coaching in this show with Janet Harvey, past president of the International Life Coach Federation. But let's begin with a call-in for any of you to thank, on the air, one great coach from your life. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-WNYC. 9692. Call in and say thank you. We'll just do this for a few minutes. To any coach who has mattered to you, sports or non-sports, and tell us briefly what that coach did for you. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Now, this can be about sports. Did a coach teach you how to set a weak side screen in basketball? You want to be that specific? Or to hold your arms when you run? Or maybe your coach helped you with sports and something deeper. Maybe you learned something about life from a coach who was teaching you a triple axel ice skating jump. Does that sound like you or an experience you've had? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And beyond athletics, did a coach save your emotional life when your parents were in no condition to help for whatever reason? Or any thank you to any kind of coach, 212-433-WNYC. People have been writing already on this, on a wide range of what a coach can mean to our lives. One public speaking coach, Jezra Kay from Speak Up for Success, writes to us about her approach and says, for her as a coach, public speaking isn't really about presentations. It's about your right to be heard and your mission in life, what you're here to say. So we can take this in many directions. Call and thank any coach from any time in your life who has coached you in sports or anything else. On our Facebook page, where we've been collecting some of these. Victor writes, the best coach is someone who believes in you, plain and simple. This world is filled with people that doubt, question, and try to mold your individuality so that it fits the status quo. A real coach pushes you to be yourself. My coach, he writes, was my sophomore English teacher, Mrs. Rush. She taught me the beauty of the English language, something I carry until this day. All anybody needs is self-assurance in this world. The rest is up to them. And Matt writes, at the turn of the millennium, I was a junior at Murrow High School attempting to pull an Intel Science talent search paper together along with about 20 other ambitious, only slightly evil 17-year-olds. The Intel kids had two terrific mentors, one more focused on guiding us through the absurdly complex development and submission process, the other, who I'll call M, a writing coach, helping to ensure that our work was as crisp, concise, and downright delicious as possible to the judges. Like many of the other kids, I formed a strong bond with both teachers, and when it came time to write my college entrance essay for the Ivy League, to which I decided to apply early, I turned to M, and the story goes on. But you get the idea of some of the non-sports examples we can get into. I will give a shout-out, as your calls are coming in, to baseball coach Jeff McKay, who I've known since the 90s, who is one of those Phil Jackson inner game kind of people. He'll be a guest briefly a little later in the show. He was all about working on your baseball skills, working on yourself in a deeper way through your baseball skills. And one of the things he coached me on was concentration, which, of course, you can take with you into any pursuit. It's working on your awareness of your body while trying to perform a complex task, physical or mental. He used to say, while trying to concentrate hard on something, a lot of people tense up. Bad idea. Be aware of your body and be the opposite of uptight. Be down loose. And I never heard that term before, down loose, the opposite of uptight. Down because you stay centered by focusing on your gut, not all up in your head, and loose is loose. Funny thing is, when I took an Alexander technique class with a group of dancers another time, it was almost the exact same thing, but in their terminology. So baseball coaching, dance coaching, whole person psychotherapy, the inner game of life as taught through any discipline. Call in to thank any coach in your life for something you got from them as we begin our Brian Lehrer Show family meeting about coaching today. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And here is, oh, look who's calling in. It's Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, former sports correspondent for The Takeaway. Ibrahim, nice to hear from you.
I had to call in, Brian. This is critical.
What you got?
Coach Jack Berger, he's in Troy, New York. He's one of the winningest football coaches in New York State football history. He's won a bunch of state championships, brought his team to the state championships a bunch of times. My junior year, we went to state semis, but we lost. And we're crying, and everyone's, you know, feeling terrible. But he pulled us to midfield, and he basically said that in your real life, you're going to have a lot more difficult things, and this will just be one of the small things that you remember. He completely put it in context, and throughout my life, I've always, always remembered that and thanked him for it.
You know, it's very current right now with Angela Duckworth, who writes about grit, and there's been all this reporting on her idea of grit as a way to get through school if you're challenged in school, and her theory hangs a lot on failure. And we had another guest from Fordham recently who wrote a book about failure and refers to Duckworth that if you're really going to get somewhere in life, failure is a big part of it and dealing with your failures. And it sounds like your coach helped you right on that point.
He let us understand that we still were valuable people and that we still mattered. And I remember some people literally just looked at each other and were like, oh, yeah. It was like we just shook ourselves out of a little coma that we had been in and then started to say, okay, let's figure out how to move on. And maybe we'll be back here next year.
Ibrahim, thanks a lot, and thanks for starting us off. Meg in New Canaan, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Meg.
Good morning. I want to thank Wes Richards. He was a man in southeastern Michigan who coached tennis. He had two sons, one that played at University of Michigan, one that played at University of Indiana. So, of course, as a junior, you wanted to kind of hang with him because he thought it could make you good. And what he always stood for was, more than anything, was sportsmanship. And if you ever were either, I'll call it a brat, or misbehaved or smacked your racket or whatever, he would always remind you that he's not going to work with you because he can't be competitive while being gracious. He wasn't going to coach you.
Go ahead.
Everything he did was giving back to the sport and giving back to kids.
One of the things that we'll talk about later in the show when we do a thing on education and coaching or coaching in an education context is discuss the coaches who set bad examples by verbally abusing their players or throwing things across the room. Did your tennis coach ever address that?
You know, he didn't. He kind of more led by example. He always basically, there was one time, this is a silly little story, but when I was 13, I lost this tournament in an inner city tournament, and I had took my runner-up trophy and I put it in the trash. And he walked over to me with the most firm face and said, "You will never do that again." And I didn't quite get what he meant. But he obviously meant where if you want to work with him, you had to behave a certain kind of way. So therefore, he led by example.
Meg, thank you so much. Great story. Let's go to Adele in Stamford with a whole other kind of coach, I think. Adele, you're on WNYC.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How about you?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an alum of UConn, and I just wanted to point out one thing before I talk to you briefly. It's Jim Calhoun.
Jim, I said John
Calhoun,
didn't I? Of course, it's Jim Calhoun. Yeah.
I thought you might have been thinking about John C. Calhoun. I'm not sure. but anyway,
from a whole other realm of history. Yes.
I had a, until, oh God, 5 or 6 years ago, I had a lovely landlady who had just survived all sorts of things. And she was born right at the end of the First World War, and she'd been through all kinds of stuff. She married a Brit, and so they were very involved in the World War II stuff. And I always told her she had a PhD in the School of Life, and she taught me a lot of things about your series yesterday about grit. She taught me how to just hang in there and keep on going. She was a lovely lady. I miss her dearly, but boy, do I love her, and I love what she taught me.
Thank you very much, Adele. That's a great one. Steve on the Upper East Side. You're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Brian. Sorry about my voice. Just getting over the flu. I want to thank Lou Amundson, New Rochelle High School, 1963-64. He taught character in a world where there was a civil rights going on. John Kennedy was killed. Our last game of our junior year was canceled. He got all the kids together in the gym, and he said, "Look, football is great and it's real important, but what happened today is the most important thing you'll probably ever experience in your lifetime. Character, no self-doubt, and have faith. Those are the things that'll get you through life." And his favorite saying to us was, "Only the game fish swim upstream."
Only the game fish swim upstream. Just clarify, what did he say was the best thing that you would remember, that this was the best moment of your life? What did you say about that?
Not the best, one of the most memorable. That it was the...
About the game?
On the afternoon of Kennedy's assassination.
Oh, I see.
He got us all together in the gym. We were all very upset about the, obviously, the murder of the president and everything. And he was able to talk to us and explain to us what the true qualities and importance of life was, not just football.
Right. There's a kind of equal but opposite story, great legendary story about the coach of the Texas Longhorns, Mack Brown, who, after they won the national championship, walked into the locker room, and they had just won the national championship. You can imagine they were over the moon, and the first thing he said to this group of 20-year-olds is, "I really hope this isn't the best moment of your lives." How about that for some perspective? And kind of equal and opposite of the story that you told. So, Steve, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. Jordan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Jordan.
Hello.
Hi there. You have a coach you want to thank?
I do, and he's a really tremendous musician in his own right. He is an acting coach to a number of trumpeters in New York, and actually I should also pay homage to Lori Frank, who passed away just a few months ago, who was trumpet coach to nearly every working trumpet player in New York. But a guy named Sam Hoyt, and I don't want to embarrass him if he's listening, but Sam has really added so many miles to my life as a trumpeter very recently. And
can I ask why you call him a trumpet coach rather than a trumpet teacher? And we'll talk about the, you know, definitional thing a little later in the show. But is there a difference between a teacher? Usually you hear of a music teacher referred to as a music teacher, maybe a voice coach, interestingly. But usually with trumpet, I think, or an instrument, it would be your trumpet teacher. So why do you use the word coach, and is it different from teacher?
It's maybe not so different in the process, but maybe just more in the way it factors, the relationship factors into my life as a professional. I kind of equate it more to like a tennis coach in a way, in so much as that he's kind of watching what I do and, you know, as one professional to another, kind of making observations and adjustments and giving insights in a way that, of course, you could call it a teacher, but the relationship is almost more like a coach.
I got you, Jordan. Thank you very much. As we'll take a few more of your thank yous to coaches of any kind before we move on. Jim in Valley Cottage, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning, Brian. I had an English teacher freshman year in high school whose name was Josephine Steele, and she had an acronym if ever there was one. She was tough as nails, and she was the type of teacher that never gave an A, and she said to me once when I got a C on a paper, she said, "Time will pass. Will you?" And that just woke me up, and it made me work. And today I make a good living as a writer, and I thank Josephine for having put the fear of English in.
Why would that make you work rather than just make you hate her?
Oh, she was just a wonderful lady, though. She was prim, and she wore white gloves to school, and to public school, you know, back in the 70s. And everyone respected her because she was tough, and she made you want to learn the English language. So we adored her at our high school.
Jim, thank you very much. Let's talk to somebody, because it's only fair since we're talking about these coaches, who's been a coach. Matthew in Chelsea, you're on WNYC. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
I guess the coaches that affected me were my brother John Borelli and a man named William Lampert, who also was a coach. And it started with me beginning to coach when my children were in the league. It was one of the most rewarding experiences that I've had in my life. But I didn't know how to coach, so I spoke to my coach advisors, and they gave me information that helped me be able to be an excellent coach. One of the most important rules they said to me was read the rule book and read it more than once. And in game situations, having read the rule book, it came in extremely handy in very tense situations. Coaching has been one of the most rewarding experiences that I've ever had in my life. It's taught me how to understand people, emotions. I've coached from little kids to high school level, AAU teams in basketball, girls basketball, baseball, and it's just this is a great topic you have, and it's just for many, many people out there doing this kind of coaching, where they're not professionals, they're just out there trying to give back a little bit to their community. One of the most impressive things that one can do, and you learn if you take that and carry it to other things you do in your life, which I do. There's so much that giving back teaches you about other things in your profession. In my profession, I do nothing that has to do with coaching, but one of the most amazing things that I've ever done.
Awesome and nicely put, Matthew. Thank you very much. It's Brian Lehrer on WNYC with our family meeting on coaching today. So there we've taken some of your thank you calls for your favorite coaches. Let's get to the more complicated question of coaching and education. The recent book by Amanda Ripley called The Smartest Kids in the World describes how in many countries with the best education systems, school and sports are completely separate. By contrast, look what we're about to embark on here in this country beginning this week, the annual ritual of March Madness, in which the best amateur basketball players in the country compete for a national championship representing what? Colleges and universities. Why? Some of the state university coaches who you'll see on TV the next few weeks are the highest paid state employees in their states, making more than the governor or the university president or anyone else. It makes no sense really at the level of values, and it is an open question at best whether the system helps more college kids than it hurts. High school is a whole other story. So now we'll clear the lines of anybody still waiting to thank a coach. And you can do that on our webpage where some thank yous are breaking out. So go read what others are writing and post your own thank you to any coach there at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But for the phones, we're going to clear the board of the thank yous and take your stories about coaching in an educational setting. If you are a high school or a college coach, how do you see your real job? What are you really paid to do? 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. How do you balance winning with educating or developing good people? Or is that balance not your job, but somebody else's job, while your job is to just go out and make them do sports well? 212-433-WNYC. If you're a parent or a student, or you ever were a student athlete, you can call in with your coaching stories, good, bad, or mixed. Or if you are or have been a high school or college coach, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And with us to help take your calls is NPR and Slate sports correspondent Stefan Fatsis. Among other things, he is author of the books Word Freak, about competitive Scrabble, and A Few Seconds of Panic, a sports writer plays in the NFL. Hey, Stefan, thanks a lot for doing this with us.
My pleasure. Good morning.
And so as people's calls are coming in, let me start here. You've written about a TV reality show about super intense youth football in Texas. And I think you described the coaches as being the worst part of that. What's that show?
Friday Night Tykes. That was actually, we talked about it on our podcast, Hang Up and Listen at Slate, and I'm working on a piece now about that show. But it is an example of the extreme and I think misguided approach to coaching. But there are also different aspects of why people coach, how they coach, and what they see as their job. And I think this is the critical part of coaching children, is that a lot of people don't really understand what their job should be.
What do we learn before we get to what their job should be? What do we learn? Because I haven't seen that series. So what do we learn about coaching in a supposedly educational environment as, I guess, a negative example from that show?
Well, what we see is coaches who believe and state explicitly that winning is all that matters, that this is an elite league. Winning is the focus here. We're not here to have kids play. Your kid might not play a down all season. The point of this league is to make them tough, show them that winning matters, and get them to work hard toward this single goal. And if in the process, well, your kid doesn't play much, too bad, because that's not what we're here to do. What you don't see in the show is a lot of kids having fun. And I think that's what is missing from this approach to coaching, and a misunderstanding of what children are capable of. We're talking about 8 and 9 year olds playing tackle football in this particular league. But we send coaches out in youth sports, particularly. We send them out thinking that, you know, these are mostly volunteers, and leagues and clubs and sports organizations are grateful to have parents step in and fill these roles that you really can't fill otherwise. But where the leagues sort of abrogate their responsibility is that they don't give any sort of solid foundation for what the coaches are expected to do. What is the goal here? What are children capable of understanding? How can we both motivate them to do well and understand that winning is important and you should really try to win, but at the same time understand that what you're building here are characters, character traits, sportsmanship,
so
determination, hustle, spirit, aggressiveness, good, being a good teammate. There are all kinds of more important values that we just don't tell people how to impart them to children.
Isn't there any kind of industry standard? Well, everybody's talking about the Common Core curriculum for America. Isn't there kind of a Common Core for high school coaches that lays out what you just so eloquently laid out and says, okay, this is your job. This is the context in which you're trying to win football games or hockey games or anything else, or not really?
I mean, there are, and there are organizations that do it very well. There's one called the Positive Coaching Alliance that has very strong values about the purpose of youth sports. And they have a lot of sort of slogans and ways to approach coaching. And one of them is that your job is to be a double goal coach. Yes, you're coaching sports and trying to get kids to be better at what they do and to win. But at the same time, you're coaching life skills. You're trying to make better people. You're trying to give children memories and models and examples for how to move through life and how to behave an attempt to succeed, but at the same time, understand that teamwork is important and that sportsmanship is important and that effort is important.
Let's take a call. Dave, is it Schofield, New Jersey?
Yeah, hello?
Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. I coach high school, junior high school football. And, it's interesting. I think so many of these kids feel so much pressure from the parents and from friends. And it gets so out of whack in terms of, the parents trying to live through their children, and the pressure they put on them is just incredibly intense, and it makes it just no fun for the kids. And it's really important that they understand that this game is for fun. That more than likely they probably won't be professionals, but they can take what they learn from playing either football, any sport, and take it further in life into whatever endeavor they choose to take.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because sometimes it's not the coaches, it's the parents who you would think have the values but are so intense.
I've seen parents curse out their kids after a game and embarrass them and berate them to the point to where it's a very uncomfortable position and spot for a lot of coaches, because you want to intervene, but that's their child. And it really makes it an unpleasant experience. And I've seen kids with incredible talent but don't want to play anymore because their parents are just out of control.
Do you ever intervene? Is there any good way for a coach to intervene in that situation?
I think the best thing to do, to be quite honest, is to have a meeting with the parents before the season starts and explain to them your rules and parameters and how best to help their kids before the season starts, and some of the rules and regulations of which you want them to abide by, and you hope that they will too, so the season could be a successful one.
Thank you very much for your call. I really appreciate it. Robert in Atlantic Highlands, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. How about you? You got a story for us?
Yeah, I got a story. I was in Baylor High School in 1983. We had a track coach by the name of Richard Trance. And it's one of the largest schools, probably around, I would say, 3,000 students, and he's been doing it for, I think, 31 years. But as far as coaching, the guy went well far and beyond the average coach. He didn't just coach you for the track team, which he did very well and took us very far. He actually made sure, personally, on a personal level, that everybody was doing okay. He actually went as far as to make sure people, when they went to college, he would actually take people to campuses or point them in the right direction. And even if you were the worst or the best guy on the team, he was the guy there rooting for you the whole season. Never pushed you to any extent, but made sure you did the best you could. But he would actually, he also installed a work ethic on everybody as far as doing the best they can. And I take it to this day, through my job, through my career, and through sports. I just think that the guy is one of the best coaches around, and he's still doing it after 30 years.
How about that, Robert? Thank you very much. So, Stefan Fatsis, to segue from our previous segment, did you have any favorite coaches coming up? I don't know if you played sports of any kind before you became a sports journalist, or just a memorable coaching moment that helped you in some way.
I played sports all the way through childhood and all the way through high school. I wasn't good enough to play at the intercollegiate level. I don't have many coaches that I remember fondly. I mean, I have a couple of little league coaches. One was a dad who just had the right spirit. And it was, I was a small kid, but I was aggressive and I hustled. And he always said to me, just keep doing that. Just keep hustling. And it was sort of a life message more than anything else. Don't be afraid to get your pants dirty, he would say. But in high school, there was a void. There weren't people that were, I was playing soccer in the late 1970s and early 1980s, where there weren't that many coaches that understood the sport. And even though there was a vacuum there, and I think that's only one part of what a coach needs to be, I didn't have that experience. And I think that's kind of motivated me to want to be a good coach as a parent. I coach my daughter, who is 11 years old, and I coach her soccer team and have been coaching them for 6 years now. And I want to be someone that in 20 or 30 years, these girls will look back and go, hey, Stefan was a pretty good guy. I learned a lot playing and we had a lot of fun, and I'm going to go work out now, or I'm going to go play in an adult women's soccer league, or I'm going to become an active adult. And that should be our goals, because 99.9% of the children that play youth sports aren't going to be professionals when they grow up. Our job is to impart a love of physical activity and of competition and of good winning and good losing.
So, listeners, we'll take more of your calls in a minute. If you are a high school or college coach, how do you see your real job? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. How do you balance winning with educating or developing good people? Or is that balance not your job but someone else's job? Also, if you're a parent or a student or you were ever a student athlete, like our previous caller, call with your coaching stories in the context of education, good, bad, or mixed, 212-433-9692. And when we come back, we'll ask Stefan Fatsis about March Madness, which starts on Thursday, and whether he thinks there are any good stories among the coaches this year, storylines he thinks America will see in the media, or coaches in top-seeded schools who he really admires or is really skeptical of. It's the Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on coaching.
Wait a second, guys. Whoever said you had to be good to play football? You play football because you want to. You play football because it's fun. You play football so you can go out there and pretend that you're Joe Montana throwing a touchdown pass or Emmitt Smith going for a long run. And even if those Cowboys are better than you guys, even if they beat you 99 times out of 100, that still leaves...
One time.
Ready?
Yeah, I guess so.
Walk on the road. Walk right side, safe. Walk left side, safe. Walk middle, sooner or later, get the squish just like grip. Here, karate, same thing. Either you karate do yes, or karate do no.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on coaching today, sports or non-sports coaching. Right now we're in a conversation about coaching in an educational setting. If you are a high school coach or college coach, how do you see your real job? Or any athletes or parents or former athletes want to weigh in on how you see the real job of coaches in educational environments, and are they doing it? 212-433-9692, and we are with NPR and Slate sports correspondent Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak, about competitive Scrabble, and A Few Seconds of Panic, a sports writer plays in the NFL. And Brian in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Brian, thanks a lot for calling in.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Brian. I've been on your show a couple different times. Thanks, and I love your topics, especially related to sports.
Thank you.
Hi, Stefan. I've heard you often, too. But I coached for like a 25-year period. I coached at high school, college. I coached college women's softball, predominantly football. I coached basketball at the high school level. My father was a coach. My grandfathers were both coaches and teachers at certain times. And I went to Teachers College, Columbia University, prior to starting my coaching career after undergraduate work. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. For me, you know, it was about being an educator and coaching. But as you look, I think, at the demographic of the coaches and the people who are involved with coaches, when I played, all my coaches were teachers at the school. Now you'll see more and more, I think, as you look at the high school level, you have people who aren't educators, who didn't study pedagogy, are in charge of our kids and teaching, and they don't know how to teach, a lot of them. And I think, but as I really look at it and look at the big picture, I think sports are a reflection of our culture. And what it is we have our values are imprinted on our sports and what we watch, and a lot of it's just about winning, and it's about finding out who are the best, who is the very best. And it doesn't look at the whole overall big picture about what we're doing with these kids. And I think a lot of it has to do is who is actually coaching our kids, and they're not educators.
And why wouldn't they be educators? I would think with today's accreditation standards, what some people might call our politically correct culture, where, you uh-huh. know, in youth soccer, you can't even have winners and losers at a very
right.
young age and all
mm-hmm.
that stuff, that mm-hmm. people who manage to be coaches in the context
correct.
Of professional education in public schools or private schools would
right.
have been trained in those values. But why not, if not?
Well, I guess it's because of, It changed. It evolved. I mean, back in college, as well, I played Division III football and coached at Division III football.
Uh-huh.
The coaches were professors. And then it evolved, like, in the late 70s, where fewer and fewer coaches became tenured professors at those levels. So that's their pressure. They didn't have any pressure on them at that point in time to win because they were tenured professors. Then what you'd started to do is replace the coaches in faculty and not from faculty positions, but administrative positions.
Right. And then.
So then in the college, so then they were vulnerable and it was all about winning. They had like year to year contracts.
Bringing in the specialists. Brian, thank you very much. And so, Stephen Fatsis, I think this is a good place to return to the high salaries and the cult of the college coach. So here again is former University of Connecticut coach Jim Calhoun. From that same contentious 2009 news conference moment, this time explicitly defending his seven-figure salary in terms of dollars and cents.
Considering that you're the highest-paid state employee and there's a $2 billion budget deficit,
yep.
Do you think that...
Not a dime back.
Not a dime back.
Not a dime back. I'd like to be retired someday.
Oh,
I'm getting tired.
$1.6 million is enough?
I'm sorry?
$1.5 million?
I make a lot more than that.
You do?
Yeah.
What's
the take tonight?
I don't know. What's the deal with Comcast
work? You're not really that stupid, are you?
Yeah, I am.
Okay.
No, really.
My best advice to you?
Yeah.
Shut up. I'm quite frankly, we bring in $12 million to the university. Nothing to do with state funds. We make $12 million a year for this university. Get some facts and come back and see me. Get some facts and come back and see me.
Thank you, Coach Calhoun. Jim Calhoun in 2009, University of Connecticut. Stephen, did you cover that at the time by any chance?
I think we talked about it at the time. And if I were one of the lawyers representing students that are taking on the NCAA and some of these lawsuits that are being filed, I'd probably want to play that tape because it gives lie to the notion that this is anything but a business. And the devolution of the coach as a faculty member is so complete now that these multimillion-dollar salaries you'd think would require or want universities to make sure that the people that are leading these students are educators, as the caller just discussed. But instead, we get a situation where they are professional coaches who are making millions of dollars, the highest paid employees on campuses. They should be made to teach. It should be a requirement of their jobs. They should be made to go back to school before they are hired as coaches. I mean, coaches will tell you that their jobs are so all-consuming that all they can focus on is coaching. And what we've created is a professional class of coaches. And you see this in the NFL, for instance, where a lot of the younger coaches have started at teams at a very young age, right out of school. They've learned about analytics. They've learned about salary caps. They've learned about scouting. They've learned about play design, but the one thing they haven't learned is about human relationships and how to deal with people. There was a spate of sort of bully screaming NFL coaches, Todd Haley, Josh McDaniels, Eric Mangini. These guys are no longer head coaches, but the NFL goes through these cycles. There's still this lingering belief that the sort of tyrant bully who is a desirable trait in coaches. You know, there's a story right now. The women's basketball coach at Boston University has been accused by former players of bullying.
Huh.
We had Mike Rice at Rutgers get fired because of allegations of bullying. So there's still this myth out there, but I think there's much more pushback among athletes who have grown up thinking differently and maybe being treated by coaches better, that there's less... there's less willingness to accept that this is a way to coach and run a program.
Judith in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judith.
Hi, Brian. I just wanted to respond to a comment. I'm a soccer mom, of course, and I wanted to respond to a comment. You know, one of the things that's really happened is that in high school, my daughter had a teacher who happened to coach soccer. He was great.
Mm-hmm.
And they also hired a, quote, professional coach, someone who coached a premier soccer team, and he was just all about the winning. And I'd have to say that, you know, as it relates to coaching these days with children in particular, what you're seeing more and more is that there are these sort of professionalized coaching sports clubs, and that's really changing the culture of sports for kids.
Judith, thank you very much. Jim in Asbury Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
All right. What you got?
I have a very unique story. I think it fits in with the March Madness and what college sports. is really about. Back in the late 90s, I was an assistant coach at St. John's University with the men's soccer program. We were defending NCAA Division I national champs.
Uh-huh.
And while I was coaching, I started doing a master's degree in theology. And in my first class, I started writing a paper just by chance on Nike and their labor practices in the sweatshops in Southeast Asia. And at the same time I'm learning about how horrible Nike is treating all their workers, St. John starts to negotiate a $3.5 million endorsement contract with them.
Huh.
And I'm now going to have to wear and promote Nike's products as part of the deal. And I tried for a year behind the scenes to negotiate myself out of that. I said, as a Catholic university, we're completely compromising ourselves. And I don't want to be a walking advertisement for a company that's exploiting poor women in the developing world. And eventually I was given an ultimatum by my head coach. You'll wear Nike and drop this or get out. And I was forced to resign.
Wow.
I held my ground in protest and became the first athlete in the world to say no to Nike and to one of these deals.
Where do you think that whole ball of wax stands today?
It's the same. And I would say it's intensified. I actually ended up, I moved to Indonesia back in 2000 to go live with factory workers to see what their lives are really like. Tried to survive on the Nike sweatshop wage. At the time it was $1.25 a day. Lost 25 pounds that month living on the wages of the workers who make the stuff that as an athlete I wore for years and never thought twice about who they were and what their lives were like. And I've spent the last 13 years of my life traveling around the country educating kids about that issue. I'm actually on my way to New York right now. I'm going to be speaking at Regis High School today doing a program called Behind the Swoosh, Sweatshops and Social Justice.
How about that?
And
so can I ask, since St. John's used to pay you to be a coach, who pays you to do this?
I get honorariums when I speak at the universities and at the high schools. And then I've done just a lot of bare bones grassroots fundraising. It's, you know, it was very, very difficult for a long time to scrape the pennies together to do what I got to do.
It took a lot of courage. I'm sure it took a lot of courage to do what you do, what you did there, Jim. And, you know, in, I don't know if you saw it. There was a big story in Deadspin, the sports site, recently about how Nike has a stranglehold on coaches and programs and track, too. And obviously the rise of the AAU basketball supercoach has a lot to do with the whole world of Nike-sponsored camps and teams.
Yeah, they're deep and wide. And you know, I got to talk about one high school in Tennessee. So I've spoken to more than 500 schools in 46 states, three different countries. Only one school has taken a stand and said, our student-athletes will not be walking billboards for anybody. And that's
yeah.
Father Ryan High School down in Nashville, Tennessee.
All right.
And they just did it this past fall. So what the kids there, what the schools decided to do, rather than the kids wearing an Adidas logo or a Nike logo or whatever, they buy the stuff that they need to buy for the kids, but then they get they have patches made up with a Jerusalem cross on it. And they cover over all the corporate logos. And there was a big story about it in USA Today. And one of the kids was quoted saying, you know, we shouldn't be advertising for any of these companies. Father Ryan should be our brand.
And it's not just Nike, I should say. It is Adidas, as you mentioned, and Reebok. And do you have any evidence, though, all these years after you quit St. John's over that, that the working conditions have gotten better from the awareness that's been raised?
Yep. They've gotten marginally better, Brian. I was in Indonesia in September. I go usually two or three times a year, and I do organizing and research trips with factory workers. And, you know, in September, I was documenting cases where Nike was refusing to even pay workers the minimum wage, despite what their code of conduct says that, you know, they'll pay the minimum wage or what, you know, Veda Manager, their former director of global operations, said that, you know, not only do we pay the minimum wage, but we pay wages that far surpass the minimum. It's absolute lies. The only thing that Nike has gotten really significantly better at is how to manage this issue from a public relations sense.
Jim, thank you very much for your call. I really appreciate it. And, yeah, again, I guess it's one thing. And whether or not Nike's better now than Jim describes as an activist, you know, I don't know. But it's one thing in a professional context. It is another thing, in my opinion, at the educational level where you're wearing the logos as a student or a coach in high school or college. Stefan Fatsis, March Madness. Are there any good stories among the coaches this year, storylines you think the country will see in the media in the coming few weeks, or coaches in top-seeded schools who you either admire or are really skeptical of?
Well, there will be some coach that will emerge because his team will make it to the Sweet 16, much the way that Shaka Smart at VCU did a couple years ago and became very prominent. He was young. He was energetic. He seemed like a good guy. Brad Stevens at Butler made it to the Final Four twice in a row, and you saw a very calm figure on the sidelines, encouraging and being very philosophical and thoughtful. He's coaching the Boston Celtics now. So there will be coaches that emerge, but a lot of our tried and true coaches are there as well. And, you know, Coach Krzyzewski, Mike Krzyzewski at Duke, will be under the spotlight again. And he sort of franchised his life as a coach into sort of business concepts. And he's a guy with a temper, and he gets red-faced. He threw a marker the other night. I mean, this happens in coaching, but there's a message you want to convey beyond what you do on the sidelines. And the guys that have the forum to do that, like Krzyzewski, like John Calipari, like Rick Pitino, they all convey sort of slightly different messages. And Calipari's is, hey, I'm here to help these kids get to the NBA, and I have no qualms about saying that about encouraging them to leave and go. I'm here to train them as basketball players, make them continue to love the game, and push them out. A lot of people don't like Calipari, but there's an honesty there in terms of what he's doing and how he conveys his message to his players. So I think as the tournament progresses, we're going to see these different sort of archetypes be exposed on national television.
I heard you're a fan of Pete Carroll, who has coached both amateurs and the Jets, though this is a fine distinction sometimes. And, of course, he coached this year's Super Bowl champion Seattle Seahawks. Why are you a Pete Carroll fan?
I'm a Pete Carroll fan. I mean, I'm not talking about how he conducted business at USC, because let's not forget, when he left there, the school was sanctioned for all sorts of violations. But in terms of the kind of culture that he seems to be imparting in the NFL, that's what I'm admiring. He's someone that is sort of very holistic about how athletes prepare. He's open to ideas like yoga and thought and sort of deep thinking about meditation, about just sort of how an athlete prepares himself to play. And he's not a jerk. He seems to treat the players with respect, treat them as adults. When I spent a summer as a kicker with the Denver Broncos on the team, Mike Shanahan was the head coach. The players loved Shanahan because he respected their boundaries as adults. At the same time, he was not very approachable. He wasn't very progressive. He ran into trouble here in Washington coaching the Redskins, just in terms of the sort of philosophy that he imparted to the team. So the good coaches, I think, have a balance. They recognize that these are adults who you need to respect and you need to give some rope to. But at the same time, that you need to sort of be tough and make sure that they understand that we're all here for a purpose. And if we can all try to achieve that purpose together, you don't have to do it by screaming. You don't have to do it by punishing. You don't have to do it by being sort of close-minded and backward. And Carroll was not close-minded or backward.
And when you talk about Carroll being into yoga and meditation, it kind of sets up the segment we're going to do in a few minutes here on the inner game of coaching, the Phil Jackson Zen approach, John Wooden. And we may read a little bit during that segment of Pete Carroll's words. He wrote the intro to the recent reissue of the book, The Inner Game of Tennis. But before you go, in our last 2 minutes, Stefan, you know, on this question of education and coaching, the more I think about it, and having been exposed to Amanda Ripley's observation recently about sports and school being separate in some other countries that do education well, I wonder why big-time amateur sports and colleges are connected at all. I mean, they're not in baseball. I mean, there are baseball programs, but baseball has a professional minor league. Is it an accident of history, like health insurance coming from our employers? Do you happen to know?
It is an accident of history. I mean, that's how they were intertwined. They've been intertwined since the late 19th century in this country. I mean, football was developed at colleges and universities. It was a different culture and a different approach to integrating education with athletics than the one that came across from England, where they were not sort of created they weren't part of the educational system in the same way, and it didn't evolve as a business in the same way. So we have this tradition of connecting them, and I disagree with Amanda Ripley on some levels. I don't think that athletics and education are mutually exclusive, nor should they be. I think there's a place for them, but I think the important thing is to recognize what the values that you're trying to get out of sports. How is this contributing to what students learn and what they will do further on in life? And I want to amend something I said earlier, which was when you asked me about if I had any good coaches. As I started to think about it, listening to one of the callers, I had a hockey coach named Cal Schmeichel, who, as I look back, recognized that we were there to have a good time. And he could be stern, but he taught us how to play better. He smiled a lot. He joked. And we won our league championship. And it was one of the most memorable athletic experiences I had growing up because of him.
Stefan Fatsis, NPR and Slate sports correspondent. Among other things, he is author of the books Word Freak, about competitive Scrabble, and A Few Seconds of Panic, a sports writer plays in the NFL. Stefan, great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian. You know, I had a pretty good Scrabble coach, too. So that's helped me helped me become a better player.
Give me a seven-letter word that goes on two triple word scores. All right, never mind. We'll do that another time. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks.